This is Bloomberg Business of Sports.
The world's changing, and what are things we can do to transform our business and engage our fans globally in different ways?
People are using their name and likeness to create more opportunities, more stakes in companies.
In order to turn the organization around, we had to turn it around not only just on the baseball operations side, but on the business operations side.
Football and any other sport is very difficult, but I like to broaden my horizons and be able to expand.
Sports need to be consumed live, and that's a big competitive advantage for intellectual property holders of sports content in the media landscape.
Bloomberg Business of Sports from Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jason Kelly.
And I'm Mike Lynch.
And I'm Michael Barr. Over the next hour, we will explore the big money issues in the world of sports and talk to some of the biggest players in the industry.
Yeah, coming up, we are going to have a very timely conversation with Milwaukee Bucks president Peter Fagan. Of course, the Bucks making a deep run into the NBA playoffs. This is a guy who's had a fascinating career across both sports and investment. They're in Milwaukee, oversees the arena as well. And anybody who's been watching TV during these playoffs has seen there's just a lot of hype, a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of heat around the Bucks there locally, and so eager to get into that conversation with him. Before we get to that, though, guys, we should talk about what's been going on in the world of sports. The biggest thing really is July 1st. It happened this week, which meant name, image, and likeness. Here we go. It's happening, and not just in the 15 states where it has been enacted by state legislatures, Lynchy, but the NCAA, literally hours before July 1st, came out and said, all right, okay, you guys can go and make some money off of your name, image, and likeness. I really feel like, not to overstate it, we are going to look back on this as the day that sports really changed. You've got deals already happening for college athletes.
The first two things that came to mind for me were Title IX and then the eligibility of freshmen to play varsity sports in college. And now this is going to be one of the biggest turning points in the history of college sports, where now the NCAA has said that student athletes can do commercials, they can endorse products, they can get money for signing autographs. They just, however, can't get paid by the university to play. So this is going to, this, you want to talk about the juggling four, five, six balls in the air. This is happening, as you said, Jason, the number of states that are going to legalize it, and who's going to have the final say? I mean, where are the checks and balances in this? And that's going to be the big problem.
Well, it's ultimately going to come down to, and it hasn't gotten there yet, to Congress, you know, I will say, Michael Barr, and I think I've asked you this question before, and I remain interested in it, which is, does amateurism or the lack thereof, which you could argue that amateurism no longer exists in college sports if players are getting paid in some form or fashion, does that change the way you view college sports?
No, and the reason why, it's, let me put it this way. I guess my best example, if you have a high school basketball team, the high school itself is not making money off the high school basketball team, but when you take it up now to college, and this has been going on for many years before this new rule, the athletes weren't making any money, but the college was making hand over fist of money over these athletes, over these teams, from the football team, the basketball team, and so on. And I always say this started way back when the video game came out for NCAA basketball. And you would see some of the likeness of some of the players in the game, and the athletes finally said, wait a minute, you're taking my likeness and my name, and I'm not getting any money out of this. It's like, wait a minute. So I always say that's the point when the match was struck and everything started to change.
So, Lynchy, and I know we've talked about this before, and, you know, you're a former college athlete, and you know, I do wonder what you think about this. I do think it may change, if not the way we watch sports, it may change where athletes end up going to college. Don't you think that's possible?
Yeah, if you get to an area that's a big market that has all kinds of companies that will elevate the profile of the student athlete, they're going to gravitate towards those schools.
already right now I'm looking on social media, and they've for instance, there's a basketball player from Baylor who now is going on Cameo, and he'll send personal videos to anyone for $45. That's happening right now as we speak. There's a bunch of players at a small school like Jackson State right now who have inked deals with Three Kings Grooming, which is a black-owned business. So it's happening right now at the very small school level. But I can only imagine when you get to a place like USC or UCLA or Clemson or Alabama, the deals that are going to be offered. I mean, you know, Fred's Ford in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. How much is he going to give, you know, Michael Barr, my starting middle linebacker, to endorse the Ford cars at his dealership?
Yeah. It's interesting, too. I mean, you're also, I think, going to have it come the other way, which is national brands essentially going through and picking out, okay, well, this is an athlete who already has a massive social following. There's a great example of this that literally came out on July 1st, the morning of July 1st, which is Boost Mobile, which is a wireless company. They endorsed one endorsements from two college student athletes. They are paying to be endorsed by these athletes. And it's twin guards, the Cavender twins, who play at Fresno State. They have massive, massive social media following, some of the biggest of NCAA athletes. To put some numbers around that, 5 million total followers across Twitter, YouTube, Instagram, and TikTok. And so if you're sitting there and you're Boost Mobile, you're going to pay them to endorse your product, because they're in the same way that they're influencers who, you know, endorsing makeup brands or other things across or outside of the sports world, I should say, this is what they're going to do. So it's not going to be for everyone. There's a question I saw on Twitter that said, you know, will we see in 2021 multiple athletes make more than $1 million? I think we will. I absolutely mm-hmm. think we will.
Yeah. And the one thing, and I've brought this up before, and I'll say it again, and we all talked about this. Now you're dangling all of this money, if you want to call it that, or whatever, out in front of a college athlete. What I worry about is somebody named Benny getting in there and wanting to fix the game. Or, you know, okay, you can win, but, you know, keep it within the spread and this and that, whatever. That's what I really worry about. And I hope that the NCAA, that they have some sort of schooling on this to the athletes where they need to know, don't do this.
Right.
Because this is going to be a mess if you do.
Everybody named Benny who's listening to this show is like, why you gotta single out the Bennies? Like, so there's some, like, you know, very, you know,
I got a cousin named Benny. He's mad as all good.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, why are you doing this?
Why are you doing me like that, Barr? Come on, I'm a clean, upstanding, fine, upstanding citizen. All right. Speaking of big money, let's talk about esports. This is something I know that's close to your heart, Michael Barr, because I believe you have an esports aficionado, an esports player in your household. Complexity. This is a franchise that's backed by Dallas Cowboys owner Jerry Jones, acquired for $26.7 million by a larger esports company. It just so happens we had the CEO of Complexity, Jason Lake, on a year ago. So this is just as the pandemic was starting to take hold, talking about the opportunities. Check it out.
Esports has definitely been pushed to the forefront of sports entertainment. There was a NASCAR Pro Invitational iRacing series that had like 1.3 million viewers, and that was on Fox. ESL has their Counter-Strike League that was meant to be played in Malta, but that was moved online, and it saw concurrent viewership of over 355,000. You know, for online matches, that's a significant number. People are watching gaming, they're participating in gaming in record numbers, viewerships at record numbers, and it's a really interesting time for our business.
Well, certainly an interesting time, and you have seen a lot of the big owners. This is what's so fascinating to me, Lynchy. You've seen a lot of the big owners, I believe, including the Crafts up there in yep. New England, invest, you know, pretty aggressively into esports. They obviously have a deep interest in real sports and non-esports. But this is where the world is going. I believe the Celtics owners have invested here as well. Ted Leonsis, who, not surprisingly, has gone there in part because he made his money at AOL, his initial fortune at AOL. I mean, these guys are in.
Well, you walk into any professional locker room, whatever sport it is, and if the players aren't watching the TV on like a baseball game, if it's a baseball locker room, they're playing esports in front of their locker with somebody else in another part of the world. And I think the owners, you know, have their antenna up. They see this, what's going on, and they realize what a great investment it is. And I mean, the Dallas Cowboys actually have like a room in their headquarters in Texas for esports. And now they've turned us into almost $27 million in that sale.
Yeah, amazing, amazing.
I am just amazed, by the way, that how esports has exploded in the past several years. And I thank you to my boy for my 16-year-old who educated me on esports, because I was watching him playing a real tournament, and the intensity involved is night and day than, you know, when he's beating dad playing Risk on the computer. It's a night and day difference, folks.
Well, thanks so much for joining us, everyone. We're here each and every week for you at the same time, talking to the biggest names in sports. I'm Jason Kelly, along with Mike Lynch and Michael Barr. You know, we like our conversations to be timely, guys. We like our guests to be sort of in the news. Well, we're certainly delivering for you this week. Milwaukee Bucks president Peter Fagan joins us in the midst of a playoff run for that team, for that city. So much excitement around these playoffs. Peter, really nice to have you with us.
Thanks for having me. Big fan of the show.
Well, thank you. So tell us about life inside the Bucks organization right now. Obviously, every one of the past few seasons has been a little bit different in the NBA, but we're taping this on a Thursday morning. Tell us what's going on with you and the team and how you're viewing this run.
Yeah, I think, you know, and I kind of am the town crier for the organization, and this is just hollow time. You know, this is surreal. This is where you're on a global platform on the Eastern Conference Finals, and these moments don't exist that much, especially like in a market, in a smaller market like Milwaukee, what it means for us coming out of a pandemic, what it means for us going into next year, what it means for us as a brand, as an enterprise, and what the prospect of going to the finals are, all like these monumental events / opportunities that you just have to prepare and really gravitate to as quickly as possible.
Peter, I got to bring up the elephant in the room, and we're kind of talking about it off air. Giannis Antetokounmpo scared the daylights out of me because he went down with a knee injury. Fortunately, your star player, it looks like there is no structural damage as we're talking.
Yeah, I think that's when you gasp. I think this is part of the sport, you know, is health. You know, nobody talks about it, but it is probably number one kind of variable is how do you stay healthy, how do you stay injury free, and you know, for all of us, the fact that he has no structural damage and that he's, you know, literally walking stairs yesterday, and Giannis, you know, is, if you don't know him, he's the guy you think he is. You'd have to fight him not to play if a doctor says he can actually walk and rehab to get it done. So, you know, I think obviously in the short term, not an option to play, but, you know, in the longer term, we'll take it day by day and see where he is. So I think optimistically the best news we possibly could have gotten. I think hopefully we kind of get through the Eastern Conference Finals, get this win at home, get on to the next game, and you know, have Giannis that has the ability to play, which would just be incredible.
Hey, Peter, it's Mike up in Boston. I was doing a little research for this interview, and I saw an advertisement that the Bucks Pro Shop is hiring temporary staff through the rest of the playoffs. I assume that's probably reflective of everything that's going on within your organization in the city of Milwaukee.
Yeah, I think labor is kind of one of these issues when you talk about operations that the whole country is going through. we have this incredible, you know, moment where we springboard into full operations, kind of from zero, you know, to beyond capacity. We've got a deer district out here in a plaza that does about 20,000 people outside, and you know, we've got 17,000 people inside, and the labor market is just crunched and very difficult to staff. So, you know, ahead of like trying to build our online audience, monetize our sponsorships, maximize our ticket prices, like our staffing challenges have been really challenging for us and for all kind of businesses as we go forward. So we are at the same time we're running towards the NBA championship, we are recruiting labor like we've never had to before.
Peter, tell us more about the Deer District, because I think anybody who's tuned into these playoffs, you know, that you have these great shots of all those fans just going nuts there outside. But my understanding, and keep us honest here, is this was not always the case. This is something that has been really created by you and the organization. We should point out that you oversee the Fiserv Forum, the arena as well. I mean, this is a master plan in many ways. Walk us through that.
Well, the owners always like to remind me, like Mark, Wes, and Jamie, that you know, the vision was build it and they will come, and Milwaukee never really had a central meeting place, never really had a living room, you know, for people to gather. And one of the visions of this was like, how do we create a destination? And we were able to acquire 30 acres of downtown Milwaukee, with the centerpiece being the arena. And really around it is like, how do we create density of people and really, you know, kind of fuel and energize the district with retail, with residential, with commercial. And that's happened. And the success of the team has been the accelerant to really make that happen in short term, and especially coming out of the pandemic, to really inject some energy and enthusiasm in downtown Milwaukee in a really short period of time has been incredible. So, you know, we're now at, you know, I don't think we ever want to say the word capacity, but we are like kind of challenged more and more as we grow about 10 or 20% every game, whether it's a road or home game, to over 20,000 people is like, how do we continue to service and kind of entertain these large groups like in the plaza on the outside? It's become almost a bigger event outside than it has inside.
That is huge, because that means so much money for the local economy, especially the local guys, the restaurants and the shops that are there. As we pass and hopefully put COVID in the rearview mirror, that has to be, as you mentioned, a shot for the economy in that local area.
No question. I mean, the thousands of hotel room nights, the rental cars, the dinners, you know, the traffic, the pedestrians. It is truly kind of the blessing that's come with winning to help supercharge, you know, the Milwaukee downtown economy much faster than it ever would have been done before.
Peter, I remember the old Mecca where the Bucks used to play, and the only place to go after the game was Major Goolsby's across the street. And 17,000 people would try to cram in there every single night. How did this explosion happen? Did it happen before this team's success, or did the Deer District need the success of the team to be where it is right now?
Well, I mean, it's kind of the perfect storm. So we certainly had the vision and the development, you know, prior to the real success of the team. I think kind of as we were peaking in 19 and kind of going to the Eastern Conference Finals in the first year of the arena, you know, we built this new area. It kind of in an instant caught fire and interest. We had to take kind of a year off, you know, from the pandemic, and now we've kind of started up again and restarted at a higher level, which is just like fantastic. So we're very nervous about, you know, when you build a new arena and you've got a new district and you've got some entertainment and eatertainment and residential, like how do you keep the momentum going? So the success certainly is paramount to fueling the restart in such a big way. And it's kind of, you know, this model of really using these super brands of teams and arenas like around districts, you know, whether it's Kansas City, whether it's LA Live, whether it's Columbus, Ohio, has really been a model to supercharge, you know, a microeconomy.
Peter, help us understand some of the kind of knock-on effects, as it were, for the business when it comes to season ticket holders, when it comes to sponsors, coming out of that bubble year into limited capacity, now full capacity, Deer District, et cetera. How do you manage the business through that, and specifically there in Milwaukee, because across the 30 franchises, everybody was in a slightly different position?
Yeah, well, I think, we don't advertise the fact that this was a devastation to the industry. You know, much like the entire country and the entire world, you know, we went from midstream of a season to zero, you know, and we've got large physical plants. We've got huge employee bases, you know, to operate these. And certainly we're fueled on content, you know, whether they be NBA games, in our case, Marquette games, concerts and family events, to kind of go to zero. So, you know, we went into a year, you know, with not much revenue and losses we had never seen before. So the ability to really jump out of the pandemic with a high-paced winning team, with excitement, with people like beyond eager to get out of their homes and socialize has really kind of has surprised us in a big way. And it is the ripple effect, you know, not just for local economy, but for us, obviously, how do we accelerate season ticket sales for next year? How do we create values for sponsorships? How do we continue to build like our online audience to monetize and things like that? So for us, like, we figured, hey, it's going to take us a year to dig out of this debt hole and kind of get back to 1920 levels. And I think if you have a deep run in the playoffs, like, what that does is kind of cut that down to, you know, we could be looking at normalcy, you know, starting next season, which is incredible.
Peter, you've got an NBA team. A lot of cities have an NBA and NHL team sharing the same arena. What kind of other events do you have to fill up the rest of the dates during the calendar year?
Yeah, so I mean, we kind of, like, you know, we had our first full year at about 150 real events, and that's, you know, half of those are kind of what I call the team sports, and whether it's Bucks, it's Marquette, it's NCAA, and then what you really do is balance that out with, you know, 40 to 50 concerts on top of that. You've got to create your family shows and think of everything from your Feld shows to your Disney on Ices to your rodeos to your WWEs to your UFCs. And then, you know, you kind of figure out where you are in the market and what you can customize and how you can do some in-house kind of concerts that would, you know, and special shows to comedy shows. You know, we think we've built this arena to be the gold standard of where people want to come, where people can really, you know, habitate and have a fun time, like, in and around the district. And it's a destination, you know, and you know, regionally, it's easier to get to Fiserv Forum from Northern, you know, Illinois than it is to get to the United Center. And how do we create that great experience? How do we attract people, you know, from a couple hundred miles and have marquee events? And make it special. So for us, it's like continuing to build that content schedule in like a very big way. And, you know, I think we should be a facility doing, you know, 200 to 250 events, you know, including another 100 events outside. And whether that's a Chris Kindle, you know, Christmas Mart to farmers markets to ice skating rinks in the summer. I mean, there's so much and so many great examples of what's done. And we're still in the kind of incubator stage of finding out what works and how do we continue to build it up.
Peter, talk to us about the fan base and especially sort of overlaying that with the arena and, you know, balancing affordability and perks and access and, you know, especially at this time where it feels like fans are enthusiastic, emboldened, and all of those things that manifest, whether it's on social media or, you know, looking at various things that are happening across pro sports. Help us understand your fan base and how you serve them from a customer perspective.
Yeah, I mean, great question, because this is a value-based fan base like you can't imagine. There are price points where there are inflection points. This is a consumer base that that actually looks at their receipts, which, like, I've never seen before, you know, coming from larger markets. You know, you never have to worry about beer prices or food prices. You do here, and you do have to figure out, you know, how we align with the brewers on, you know, what our 20-ounce beer price is in a big way. People do not want to get ripped off. People want value for their money. People have kind of stayed on what's affordability for certain ticket prices and what the balance is. And you know, we're challenged. We do not have an 18-million person DNA like New York. You know, we have a million people in the seven surrounding counties, maybe 600,000 in metro. You know, I was just in Atlanta, you know, as we play the Hawks. You know, that's a 7-million person, you know, metro market. You might be able to make some mistakes, you know, as you acquire fans and retain fans. Like, in our business, like, we really don't have we don't have the luxury of losing, of attrition in any big number. So we've got to be a winning team. We've got to create unbelievable value and unbelievable service to kind of keep them and work hard for every customer.
And so just to follow on that, does that change the pricing dynamics? Does it change the way you think about suites? How does that manifest sort of day-to-day or even strategically?
So it really makes you think about how you segment your pricing in your marketplace. It's like, you certainly can have premium. You certainly can have, you know, corporate-driven products. You can certainly have high-net-worth individual products, you know, whether they be the first three rows, whether they be suites or lofts or premium areas. But you really have to balance it, you know, with affordability and the ability to bring in. And, you know, in this market, you are as much a business as you are a community partner. Hmm. So you cannot disenfranchise, like, the general public in a big way. And that's a balance, you know, that I've learned and we've learned, like, over the last 5 years, that some markets don't have to think about as much. And we really do have to have that consideration to get that. So it's a much deeper thought out algorithm for ticket pricing, you know, for instance, than it might be in a larger market.
You know, Peter, we were talking right before we came on air about one of the things I'm personally most fascinated with, and I dare say you are too, which is the change that we've seen in ownership across the NBA. It's happened in a lot of sports, but it feels most marked, candidly, in the NBA. And you guys are pointed to as really the tip of the spear in many ways when we think about Mark Lazary, Wes Edens, and Jamie Dimon coming in and really making some pretty bold decisions on the court and off in the arena. We were talking about before and thinking about pricing and all of that. You worked for Berkshire Hathaway before. You understand big name investors probably better than anyone. Help us understand how that plays out in this particular franchise.
Yeah, I think the one great thing about the NBA is it truly is a collaborative. So on the court, like, beyond competitive and fierce and it's an arms race, but off the court, it really is best practices and kind of like what you're seeing. So if you think of the evolution of ownership, you know, of pro sport teams, I mean, not just our guys who are like the most incredible board of directors you can ever imagine. You know, we've got Mike Fascitelli who ran Vornado on commercial real estate, and very few questions, you know, don't have answers when we're thinking about development, and Wes Edens who, you know, helped pioneer the private equity field, and Mark Lazary on the distressed debt, and Jamie Dimon. But look throughout the league, you know, like, you've got, you know, media and digital expert like Ted Leonis. You know, you've got Dan Gilbert, you know, who's rebuilt the city of Detroit. You know, when you talk about, you've got Steve Ballmer who built, you know, Microsoft. So when you think about, you know, kind of like this concentration of knowledge, success, process, and growth, like, it's you can't put a value on what that does for our ability to have best practices, to use examples, to collaborate, to really evolve these sports businesses into, you know, much bigger entities.
There are six words also that bring up big time revenue. Broadcast rights, broadcast rights, broadcast rights. That has changed the face of major sports, especially in the NBA. Can you expand more on that?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, for the value of, obviously, the national broadcast deals have been the fuel to really increase these values. And then maybe in the last 10 years, you've really seen, especially in the NBA, what global rights have done, you know, especially in Asia, for distribution and brand and revenue, you know, for the league and for the teams. And now I'm going to, you know, you're going to get, you know, we're going to kind of slip into the next generation of like, what does media look like in the future, whether it's over the top, streaming, a mix of traditional. I mean, it's really like an incredible time. And, you know, pro live sports is just like one of those things that's like a hot commodity, hot content, and really probably drive like what that future of live events looks like. So it's really exciting. I mean, we've got a local media deal with Bally Sports. We've got our national deal with Turner and ESPN, you know, that fuels it. But it is, you know, how people digest the product, and it's only going to get bigger, and it's only going to get wider, and we're only going to get, you know, more impressions from more places around the world.
So, Peter, what's around the corner for the Deer District and the Milwaukee Bucks as we head into July 2021 and the success you've had so far?
Yeah, so there's some physical plant stuff. We're about to break ground on a hotel on the property. We're kind of in the pre-development stage of some residential and some more commercial in a big way. We're kind of digging out of that, you know, pandemic side and navigating what the entertainment side looks like to really book up, you know, the rest of this calendar year and really kind of, you know, what I see kind of in the entertainment side as just kind of a year we've never seen before, as concerts and shows get out, you know, in 22 in a way that they have never been. So that'll be kind of exciting as we ramp it up. And for us, like, we're looking, you know, to sustain growth. We've got one of these rare moments where, as a team, you know, our centerpiece of the Bucks is we've got Giannis signed for a long-term extension, Drew Holiday, Chris Middleton. You know, it's one of those rare moments where you've got the core of a very competitive championship caliber team signed for a longer period of time. And we think, you know, the business perspective of that is like, we can go out to market and sell like higher and longer term than we've been able to do in the past with that value proposition that we're going to be a championship competitor for a long time.
You know, Peter, it's so interesting that that's where you went, because it's very much where I wanted to go next, which is that, you know, the contours of the business of pro basketball and the business of the NBA, obviously moving in a much more aggressively global way. It's the second most popular sport in the world, as you well know, behind football in the global sense, not American football. But there's also this moment where it's an incredibly star-driven league. You see players decamping every season for greener pastures here and there. You talked about the fierce on-court rivalries, but also sort of the collective. What does the NBA collectively have to do, and what's your role in it in being, for lack of a better term, sort of innovative around the business? You know, you guys have done a good job with labor collectively, as it were, but how do you grow this larger pie?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'll revert to like the Board of Governors, ownership, and Adam as just being constantly driven by constant improvement, like audits, refinements, and focused on growth. You know, so I think as we look at the league, there's so many kind of interesting, kind of fascinating things going on, whether it's expansion, whether it's global expansion, whether it's academies, whether it's new media prospects. I think it's also like the game itself. Like, do we look at in-season tournaments? You know, how do we tweak All-Star Weekend? So I think one of the things that gets me like really excited and enthusiastic is maybe Adam and the owners are pleased, but they're never satisfied. And that's like really exciting, you know, that we're constantly looking for kind of like what is the next, and to stay ahead of the curve and to innovate. And, you know, in its own special way, the bubble was that, you know, like, how do we take charge and own this and really, really pave the path for for restarting pro sports in the world. And that's an exciting example of like how cool it is to be part of the NBA.
You know, I want to follow on that quickly, if I can, and to call back to something you said earlier about the collective. And, you know, in the same way that we've seen this change in owners, I dare say we have seen an elevation, and this is with all due respect to people who have sat in your seat and similar seats before, but an elevation of the role that you're in, you know, in terms of, you know, you think about the Steve Koonens and the Cent Marshalls of the world and the Abundandis in Brooklyn. I mean, I feel like y'all are sort of leveling up too in some perspective. And I wonder if you see that and what that level of the collective is like and how you guys sort of draw on the experiences of each other.
So I think, and we were there before, but I think the pandemic definitely put us all together in a way that we had never been before on a daily and weekly and kind of bonded us. And it is like transparency. And I call Chris McGowan in Portland for best practices with labor. I call Koonin on media, John, you know, on ticketing. Like we are a sharing collaborative. I think Teambo, like team marketing and business operations, kind of run by Amy Brooks at the NBA has kind of like set the template down for almost like the internal consulting best practices model for how to bring these teams and these leagues together so we all kind of flourish in a big way. So I think on the operating side, you know, we're now owned by folks that own several, you know, have come from owning or managing or building like large companies or several companies and they look for, you know, true operators, you know, and kind of people who are focused on growth and people who have had success, you know, organizationally. And it's kind of all built up for this evolution of what these enterprises have become.
When I read this, I was not letting this go. You are the creator. And you created this last year of Cream City Cluckery. And what it is for delicious chicken tenders. And first of all, what made you come up with that name? And second of all, how did you get into this?
Gentlemen, add an hour to the show. You've now hit my passion. Forget ticketing, forget sponsorship, forget media. The world is about the greatest chicken tender that's ever existed. So I'll tell you, you talk about culture. Like, how'd we come up with this? We overnight had a facility that had the largest kitchen in the state of Wisconsin. We had a sports bar that, you know, is a $7 million store that went completely flat. And we said, my God, we have this infrastructure. And we had one of our managers who runs our food and beverage just say, like, why aren't we doing a ghost kitchen? And we said, ghost kitchen, why don't we brand the hell out of this? Use all of our assets, charge up the kitchen, and see if we can create a franchise and have some fun with this as we're not playing basketball. And you know what? Perfect timing. We're about to open two more physical cluckeries. It's Ghost Kitchen. In our head chef had kind of come from the South with like an unbelievable recipe, some butter cake, and created, you know, on-demand delivery and pickup system that, you know, started to do a few thousand dollars a night, like during COVID, and kind of hit it off and great product. And listen, it's not going to pay the expense side of our player salaries and coach, but it certainly is like a fun venture where we're able to leverage off kind of our equity in Milwaukee and Wisconsin, create a cool brand and a great chicken finger. Like, it's off the charts. I'm happy. You guys should set foot in Wisconsin. Like, free cluckery on me.
Whoa.
Oh, boy.
Where's my plane ticket, exactly, man? We got to go.
Bar just left. Sorry. Sorry, guys. He literally dropped his headphones.
Did you actually have this much fun in any other job you've had in your entire life? Because your enthusiasm is jumping through my headsets right now.
So I've been kind of lucky. So I got out of school and I went to Six Flags theme parks. And if you told me for my years there, if I was a park president, I'd be that would be the dream, you know, I'd ever have. And then from Six Flags theme parks. I went to Madison Square Garden, and I was hired by Ernie Grunfeld, and I was in my hometown, like, running marketing and sponsorship for the New York Knicks. I thought I'd pinched myself and gone to heaven. And then I went into this private aviation world of Marquee Jet and then to NetJets, and I thought that was the coolest thing I had ever done. And then these guys kind of, I don't know if they plucked me. I might have glued myself to them for this opportunity. But if you had ever told me that there was an opportunity to run one of the 30 franchises, kind of build a district and reinvigorate a city, be part of a brand and part of the story, I would have just told you, like, not in a million years. So I think, knock on wood, like, after almost 6 years, like, I'm as amped up, especially you're talking to us as we're in the Eastern Conference Finals. So add some amp to it. But you know, this is pinch yourself magic wand stuff. So this is just awesome. And I kind of say this to people here, like, if you can't be amped up in enthusiasm, like, in a job for a pro sports team that, you know, kind of is growth and fun, like, you are definitely in the wrong place.
Well, I want to just wrap up by asking you a question related to that, which is, you know, as you think back and hopefully for Bucks fans, maybe less so for Hawks fans, there's more to come. But I do wonder, because your job is different in the sense that your emotions, your revenues, all of it sort of rises and falls on this very public product in many ways. And so much of what you're working on, everybody gets to see, but also we're also invested in our teams. Is there a moment that you have where, you know, just as a fan of your organization, you're really going to remember, you think, from this playoff run?
You know, it's so funny. Like, I think, like, you know, I remember, like, the cathartic moments of, like, opening the arena. I remember getting funding for the arena. You know, the one thing I've started to learn, and it really is impossible from, like, being in this sport, is kind of the one thing I take away from the players, like a Chris Middleton, like a Giannis, and anything, is, you know, it's one game. You know, it's like one thing. Do not you know, take one chapter and make it the book. Like, you know, you're going to play again. How do you recover? That's not to say that I put on a strong face after Giannis goes down and we lose the game and I don't cry in my hotel room. Like, that's fine. Like, you can get upset. But this is a much bigger, you know, kind of opportunity. And I think, like, listen, you have to maximize every opportunity you have. And today we're in the Eastern Conference Finals. We are planning to be in the finals. We are an NBA championship. I don't know any other way to do it, and what does that look like? And if you don't do it, you certainly had a taste for it, and you've got to use that, you know, to as motivation to go into the next season.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there. Peter, thank you so much. Really, really good to catch up with you. Best of luck through this. And it's been really fun, I have to say, to watch all the energy and excitement through the television. It really comes through. And as Lynchy said, it comes through in talking to you as well. And it's fun for us to hear that sort of enthusiasm around the business of sports. So thank you so much.
Guys like Lynchy for Boston and Barr, like, I know you're going to go through some tough times, so you're welcome to Milwaukee anytime. We'd love to have you.
I'll be scooched up to the television set, man, for the draft. It's like, okay, let's see if we got something for Milwaukee now.
Well, good luck. I think. Listen, Detroit gets good. That's good for all of us. We're dying for competitive set. That's awesome to have good Midwest competition.
All right. In the meantime, we're going to take you up on that chicken tender offer. But yeah. It's really good. Really good. Thank you so much. All right, guys. Well, really good to get some time with Peter there. And Lynchy, you nailed it. I mean, a lot of enthusiasm there. Look, there's a lot to be enthusiastic about. And I think he said something really important there toward the end of the conversation, which is that from a business perspective, you like to be in Milwaukee right now, because regardless of what happens through this weekend and through the rest of the NBA finals, this is a team that clearly there's been some investment in, And that makes his job easier. This is not a super team cobbled together. There's some long-term investments being made there. And that's, it candidly, that's good for business.
It is. And they're a likable team. They're an embraceable team by the average NBA fan or basketball fan. You look at the Brooklyn, okay, they concocted, they came together, they almost colluded to put the three superstars together. This team was just put together like teams have been put together in the past. And they have a great crowd out there. Giannis is a very likable guy. He's the league MVP. And they got a great supporting cast. And as Peter said, they've got them signed to long-term deals, a lot of these guys. So good things are going to keep happening for this franchise.
Bar, what'd you take away there?
Oh, we got to go get some of those chicken tenders, yeah. Man. Cream City Cluckery. My point is, as we've been having this theme all through this show, and Lynchy, you hit the nail on the head. He has such excitement. And when we mentioned about Cream City Cluckery, man, it's we could buy a franchise.
We went to 11 there.
I admire anybody who, more than just obviously the Bucks, obviously are very strong, but that starts a whole brand new franchise, a whole brand new branch, and they start it off, and you have that excitement. God bless you, because that's the spirit that you have to be an entrepreneur.
All right, so lots to take away there, and we'll see what happens in the NBA playoffs. Let's do the number of the week.
My goal is to be the number one pick. That's something I've been dreaming of since a kid.
It feels better to be number one than number five.
I wear the number because of Mike.
We have a chance to go for three in a row.
Good numbers at a good time.
When I first started wearing that number, I was just happy and proud.
Bloomberg Business of Sports, the number of the week.
All right, now, I got to set this up. So there's a little bit of a setup here. Let me explain. Chip Ganassi sold his NASCAR team to Justin Marks. He's the owner of Trackhouse Racing. And he declared that he will pull out of the nation's top stock car series at the end of this season. Now, one of the things that happens when you buy a NASCAR team that's established like Chip Ganassi is that you buy a charter. And because Ganassi has two cars, that means two charters. Now, the terms of the deal were not released. But what I want to know is how much, as of 2 weeks ago, are two charters in NASCAR? And if anybody doesn't know what a charter is, it means basically that you have an agreement that you're going to show up at the race with those two cars to compete. And I will give you something else. Each week, it costs about $400,000 to run a NASCAR for that one race. Just really? So, just to give you that. That along line, $400,000 it costs for a car, but it costs $400,000 because you got the crew and everything going on, and that's about $15 million a year. So what I'm asking, two charters, how much does that cost?
I'm gonna say, so the total for two is $12 million.
I got my little calculator out here. I'm gonna go with $16 million.
Actually, Jason is closer. It is at least $10 million for a pair of charters. And that was 2 weeks ago. At least $10 million. And the charter is important because what that does, it tells the sponsor, hey, we're showing up. So if you want to sponsor our car, here you are. That's an important thing if you're going to try to sell a sponsor to come join your team.
Interesting. So. All right. That is a rabbit hole of NASCAR that I never thought that I would go down, but I now understand a little bit more about the economics of racing, the louder type.
Yes.
not Formula E, which we're going to talk about next week.
The guttural.
Well, you've been listening to Bloomberg Business of Sports. We're here each and every week for you at the same time, plus online wherever you get your podcasts. Catch those. They drop on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays. I'm Jason Kelly. Find me on Twitter at Jason Kelly News.
And I'm Mike Lynch, thrilled to have a conversation with Peter Fagan, the president that made Milwaukee famous. I'm Mike Lynch. You can follow me at LynchyWCBB.
Chicken, chicken, winner, winner, chicken dinner. I'm Michael Barr on Twitter at Big Barr Sports. You're listening to Bloomberg Business of Sports and Bloomberg Radio around the world.